Welcome to the Big Three Podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three Pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome to The Big Three. My name is Mark Rader. I'm the senior pastor here at Guymere Baptist Church, and for the next half hour or so, your host of The Big Three. We are continuing as a community of faith our series entitled The Fruit of the Spirit, A Life Changed by Jesus, exploring broadly the fruit of the Spirit that Paul lists in Galatians chapter 5. And on Sunday, I had a bit of a look at the fruit of joy, which at first glance to me seemed like an unusual fruit to include because it is experienced, I think, differently than the other fruits. And the way you practice joy is something that often kind of comes unexpectedly. It's kind of part of the purpose of joy, I suppose, and its character. It made it seem like an odd thing to list. And essentially, I think Paul puts joy second in the list because so often joy and love are connected. We had a look at Philippians chapter 1 and Paul's introduction and his deep affection for them, which is part of the reason why he prays for joy or prays with joy. Chapter 2 in Philippians, where Paul says, "You make my joy complete by being like-minded and sharing the same love." Jesus says something similar in John chapter 15. And so that seems to be the connection between these. And then we looked at a handful of ways that we can seed our lives so that there's a harvest of joy in terms of gratitude and loving one another, because those things go together, which is fairly significant, and others. So the questions came out of that, and in particular out of a couple of passages that I referenced, and one that I was going to reference and didn't, and someone picked up on it, which I thought was fantastic. So here are the three questions for today. First of all, given joy is somewhat experiential, how can we know that the joy we experience is from the Spirit? Which is a really good question to ask, because it's the question, I suppose, that sat underneath many of these sermons and many of our reflections. What's the difference between the fruit of the Spirit and the fruit of a good life? Is it possible to have the fruit of love or joy or peace or whatever it is and not have the Spirit? Right? So there has to be a distinction between them. So that's a great question to start with. Secondly, what does it mean that the joy of the Lord is our strength? This is a reference to Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 10, I believe it is. And it's probably the most well-known verse in Nehemiah, but is a little bit of an odd verse. And I was toying around with whether or not to mention it on Sunday and didn't. So I was quite delighted that question got asked, because I wanted to explore a little bit more. And then the third one is, what did James mean when he said we should count it all joy when we encounter trials? And that was a passage that I did refer to when I was talking a little bit about the benefit of joy. One of the benefits of joy that you find in Scripture is its close connection with suffering, that there's something that sustains the joy set before Jesus sustains us, right? There's something good coming so we can get through the hard times, but there's also this experience of joy in the trial, which is quite unique. And I mentioned James's opening, and so that's the question related to that. So I'm looking forward to that, so why don't we jump in? So given that joy is somewhat experiential, and I think that is part of our experience of joy, right? There's a sense that something happens and we experience joy. It's hard to manufacture joy. Now, the other source that I was thinking about trying to include, or at least I did some thinking about, was C.S. Lewis and his his descriptions of joy. So he would see his salvation journey as being one in pursuit of joy. He talks about his early life and experiencing joy, this kind of unexpected moment, and that reminded him that he was made for something more than this world, that there's something outside of us that just sparks that in us, not that he used the word sparked, then that points to something beyond. And so his kind of description of his conversion, the book is called Surprised by Joy. But I didn't go there. At any rate, given that joy is somewhat experiential, how can we know that the joy we experience is from the Spirit? And so I think there's a couple of things that spring to mind in terms of how we can identify a joy that is, you know, even if it's not a bad joy, right? It's a joy that's just common to all people versus a Spirit-filled or a Spirit-led joy. And I think that the two things that spring to mind, first of all, are, I guess, what are we joyful about, right? So if it's the joy of the Spirit, then you would imagine that the things that we are joyful about would be the same things that the Spirit rejoices in, right? And if it's the things that the Spirit rejoices in, then those are the things that Jesus rejoices in and that God the Father rejoices in. That there's a sense that what God finds joyful, what God rejoices in, we ought to be rejoicing in. So, you know, again, when I was letting you in on how much, how widely sometimes these sermons and sermon preparation goes, but I spent some time looking at the German word Schadenfreude. I don't know exactly how you pronounce it. I have a German heritage, but never learned to speak the language, obviously, which is the joy in someone else's suffering, right? So, you know, it's the whole you know, the physical humor, you know, someone bangs into a wall and we laugh, or at least I do. And, you know, and obviously there's kind of a darker edge to the enjoyment of someone else's pain or suffering, right? But that would be, of course, not the joy of the Spirit, right? So, you know, someone bangs into a wall, I laugh. That's probably not the joy of the Spirit. Now, that's probably just happiness as well, or just general humor, whatever the case is. So I think if we can identify the source of our joy, right? And if it's the sort of thing that we think that the Spirit would rejoice in, then that's probably an indicator that that's more likely the joy of the Spirit. So delighting in someone's growth or someone's success or someone's good decision or rejoicing with someone, right? We're told to, you know, weep with those who weep and to rejoice with those who rejoice in. And so I think that there's a sense that when we are joyful because of something good, right? Something good that reminds us of God's plans and purposes, that reminds us of God's intentions for humanity, that reminds us of, you know, the best in us. I think that's more likely to be the fruit of the Spirit. I think that related to that, I think you could probably, I wouldn't confine it to the church, but when those things we're rejoicing in, the advances, the victories, the successes, the goodness, whatever it might be, occurs within the family of God, like within the community of faith, and we rejoice in that, I think that's even a greater indicator because there's that alignment with the Spirit. So I think that's one set, right? So the whole thing about is our joy wrapped around something that points to the work of God, right? To the things that God rejoices in and that would please him, right? I think a second thing is that it is a joy that transcends our experience. So it's a joy that remains even when situations or circumstances become more difficult. This kind of taps into that whole joy in suffering piece, that there's a sense that the joy that we experience, either in the experience itself of knowing that God is with us or knowing that there is a future that's bright and good for us, that joy then sustains us in the midst of those troubling or difficult circumstances. Because that's the kind of joy that the Spirit provides. So there's the alignment piece. I think there's the does it last, right? Is it a fleeting joy, or is it something that sustains us in the midst of various circumstances? I think those are I think those are two ways I think we could discern whether the joy that we're experiencing is spirit joy rather than just, you know, joy as anyone might experience it. And I think, you know, to some degree that same kind of paradigm works for the distinctions between the various fruits and the of the spirit that Paul lists and the fruit of a good life. I think that there are, you know, the intention of love, the direction of love, is it trying to fulfill God's plans and purposes? Is it self-sacrificial like Jesus's was? Is it redemptive? Is it exemplary? Like the alignment with and the connection to the church, I think, becomes really quite significant. Not that the fruit of the Spirit is confined to the church, but it is striking, I think, that Paul is writing to a church that is experiencing some community conflict, right? There's some divisions within them, and the fruit then kind of plays a particular role in the unity of the church, and therefore the ability of the church to do the task that God has assigned to us to continue to extend his kingdom. So I think, you know, whether that's the alignment piece or whether that's a wider category, another category, does the joy that we experience, does it further the work of the church? Does it further the work of God in the world? So I think those are some of the ways that I would think about joy in particular in terms of its spirit, identifying it as spirit joy rather than just kind of a happy moment. The second question is, what does it mean that the joy of the Lord is our strength? This is, as I said, it's from the book of Nehemiah, chapter 8. And it's a curious phrase. I'm not sure it occurs anywhere else. But the joy of the Lord is our strength in Nehemiah takes place in a curious context. So the people have returned from exile. They've returned to Jerusalem, and 50, 60, 70 years later, Nehemiah has come and he is rebuilding the walls of the city of Jerusalem. And the walls get rebuilt relatively quickly, but the focus of the book actually lies on the, shall we say, the parallel rebuilding of the community. And beginning in chapter 8 and going through to chapter 10 of Nehemiah, we have this really quite remarkable and somewhat unique story where the people, and what's unique about that is normally it's the king or somebody coming to the people and saying, you all need to gather and listen to me. But the people say to Ezra, bring out the book of the law and read it to us. And so Ezra brings out the book of the law, and he doesn't read it in the courtyards of the temple or at the gates of the temple. He actually reads it on a platform that they put up, I think outside the water gate. Essentially, it's in the CBD. It's not at the temple. It's in the public space, and they build a platform for Ezra, and he reads the law, and then there's a bunch of Levites, the priestly tribe, and they explain the law to the people. And so there's this kind of remarkable moment when the people are asking for the law to be read. The law is read and explained to them. And then we find Nehemiah and the Levites having to comfort the people because they start weeping. And they're weeping, and Nehemiah says, don't weep. This is a day of joy. The joy of the Lord is your strength. And the question about the joy of the Lord, I think, is related a little bit to the weeping, right? You know, we talked a little bit about joy in suffering, right? And that's probably the best way to think about what Nehemiah is saying. Because if the people, for instance, were weeping because they were repentant, right? Like if they'd listened to the law and they'd just realized how far short they had fallen and were repenting, you'd find it, I think, difficult to believe that Nehemiah or Ezra or the Levites would say, stop repenting, stop crying. Like none of this confession stuff, right? Like that's an odd thing. So it seems that their weeping is is something else. It may have included a little bit about that. We're told that they were rejoicing because they understood the law later on. But as the story unfolds, we actually have this really long prayer. It's unhelpfully titled in the New International Version as the people of Israel confess their sins. If you read the prayer carefully, there's almost no confession. It's actually a lament, basically saying, God, you've done all these amazing things, and you know, you've been so gracious and faithful to us, and yet here we are, still suffering. You know, we're still waiting for the promises that you made to us to be fulfilled, like we're in all sorts of strife. And then they make a covenant about what they will be doing. So the prayer, I think, provides us with some context that their weeping is not so much about their sinfulness or their lack of faithfulness. It's about the fact that they are still, albeit now in a city with some relatively new standing walls, they are still a much reduced people. They're still waiting for the promises of God to be fulfilled, that they are still waiting for one like David to rule them. They're still waiting for the kingdom to be reestablished. They're still waiting for their enemies to be reduced, and for the nations to come to them to hear the law as they have heard, to see what it looks like to live in relationship with the Lord. And that seems to be why they're weeping, and therefore the joy of the Lord is our strength, I think, fits inside of that context. That what Nehemiah, I think, is saying to them is that it is, if I can reword it, it is the Lord's joy that is our strength, right? And what brings joy to the Lord? Well, there's the sense of His will being completed, right? His plans and purposes coming to fruition, the blessing that He had promised all people through Abram's descendants to coming to pass. And the prayer kind of builds on that idea, this idea that the Lord's plans and purposes are not yet completed, and He said that they would be, and what are we going to do about it? And they commit themselves to, you know, be obedient and faithful in a number of particular ways. So I think that the joy of the Lord is our strength, is speaking about the Lord's joy, His favor, right, that we participate in, right, because the people were His people, right? They were part of His plans and purposes. And so when things were going well for them, when they were faithful in particular, then that meant that other people were drawn to the Lord. And so there's this sense that doing the mission of God, right, doing the things that God is on about, and those things that please Him, the things that bring Him joy, that's our strength. I think that's how I would... That's how I would try to explain that passage. It's a curious one when you read it through. The people celebrate one of the great festivals. It's not the Day of Atonement, which I think is also interesting. They celebrate the Festival of Tabernacles, even though the Day of Atonement was in there, which also suggests that what's going on is not repentance of sin. Again, there may have been some repentance, but that's not the primary focus of it. So I think the context helps us make sense of it. And as I said, I was thinking about mentioning the joy of the Lord being our strength. And one of the reasons I didn't on Sunday was what you just heard. It would take too long to explain what in the world the joy of the Lord is our strength is all about in its context. And I felt that it would probably end up being a little bit distracting in the context of a 25-minute sermon. So thank you, whoever answered that or asked that. I was very keen to look at that. When I saw it come in, I thought, oh, that's a cracker. I'm going to have some fun with that. So I did. Whether you had fun listening is another matter altogether. But let's move on to our third and final question. So this is another passage that I did refer to in the sermon, which is the opening of James, where James says, kind of his first words almost, are, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, when you go through trials of all kinds." And the question is, what did James mean when he said we should count it all joy when we encounter trials? And again, the context helps make some sense of that. Both the context of the whole letter of James, where there does seem to be some low-level persecution that they're engaging in, so that they're experiencing and that they need to kind of be encouraged to persevere. And perseverance is actually the immediate context. James goes on to say, consider it pure joy when you experience trials, because you know that trials produce perseverance. Let perseverance, he says, continue its work so you become mature, not lacking in anything. And so I think for James, the if I can put it this way, James is saying that the joy that we experience ought to be kind of a foretaste, a foreshadowing, the entree to the maturity and the joy that will come from being mature and from having persevered, right? It's kind of in the same category as the example I gave out of Hebrews 12, that we should fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and is seated at the right hand of the Father. There's a sense in the way that's described where Jesus looked forward and recognizing what was to come, the good that was to come, the joy that was to come, was willing to go through the difficult times, right? To go through the difficult period. I think it's in Hebrews as well that the author talks about, makes the parallel with labor pains, that a woman goes through labor pains, and that's not a great thing, but when the child is born, the labor pains are largely forgotten, right? Until the child spills milk all over something when they're seven, and then it's remembered, right? But there's this sense that the labor pains and what they will produce make those labor pains, I'm not going to say, you know, worth it, but, you know, like they're part of the process, and there's joy at the end, right? There's joy at the end, and that kind of swallows up the difficulty. And so James, I think, is doing something similar, right? About saying, like, look ahead to what it is that these trials are actually producing and the joy that will come from these trials. That there's a sense that the joy that is to come will totally exceed that which we're experiencing now. So allow these trials to produce that perseverance. And perseverance is very important. I mean, it's still important. But in the early church, particularly in the face of persecution, as they were, the scholars believe that there was a real, at least in the first generation of Christians in particular, this really clear sense that, you know, Jesus was coming back, right? Like, you know, when Jesus ascends to heaven, the angels say, hey, he's coming back. And so there was this kind of immediacy to it. And so there's this expectation and this hope and this immediacy that kind of, I wouldn't say wore off, but, you know, over time it gets moderated a little bit. Like, it's been 2,000 years. And while we hope Jesus returns soon, like, we're kind of prepared if he doesn't, like, we can kind of keep rolling. And in the early church, I think there was this sense of expectation and the need to persevere while they waited for what had, I think what they had hoped would be a short time and had turned out to be a much longer one than they had expected. So I think the perseverance as the goal, as the final outcome, becomes really quite significant. And, you know, I think, you know, in Hebrews and a little bit in James, this is connected to salvation, right? So in the book of Hebrews, the author talks about salvation not as something that we have received, but something that we inherit. In other words, like, we're written into the will, right? We're in line to receive all this. There's nothing that can take that away from us, but we have to wait, and we have to persevere, and we have to kind of get to the kind of the end before we receive the reward. And so perseverance and salvation were really closely connected together as well. So I think that's what James is focused on, right? To a group of people who are experiencing trials and who are then questioning, as we often do, like, is this God's plan? James kind of says, yeah, it is. This is part of God's plan because it creates a perseverance in us. And perseverance, right, when it bears fruit, brings maturity and completion to our faith. And that's a thing that is worth worth experiencing the trials for. So the joy that we experience in the midst of trials is the fact that it's building perseverance in us. It's the joy of feeling stiff after a good workout, right? Where you kind of go, you know what? I'm a little bit healthier today than I was yesterday. I'm really sore today. But that indicates that there's something happening. And so while I'm not happy about the fact that I can hardly move, I am joyful that I am becoming more fit, or I'm becoming stronger, or whatever the case might be. I actually do really like the metaphor of birth as well, because the joy of a child being born is different than the pain that comes with the birth. Right? The joy of a child is just totally different. It's not as if the birth of the child brings renewed health or comfort to the body, but there's just a joy that just totally transcends it, right? Having children, having a family, like, it's just very, very different. And so I think there's something in that image that goes beyond the, you know, their short-term pain for long-term gain. Like, that's not what you would ever say to a woman in labor, because they're two completely different things. The labor pains are producing something and will lead to something so other, so remarkable, so amazing, that the joy that's associated with it is just different. And I think that is part of what James is exploring as well, that the joy that is to come, the joy of maturity and completion and not lacking anything and persevering in that space, it's unlike the trial. It's not as if it's not an equal reward to the pain you're experiencing. It is just so much better, so different. I can't even put them in the same category. So I think that's kind of what James is getting at in that space as well. So those are the three questions. Thank you to those of you who submitted those. I enjoyed going through those. I think this is one of those things that brings me joy. And looking forward to the next couple of weeks as we wrap up the series. Rox is going to be sharing, and we're actually going to be, I think she's got four of the fruits. So we're kind of moving a little bit more quickly now as we head into December, and we'll wrap it up the week after that. So looking forward to the questions that come out of this next week, and hope that you can join us either on site or online, and that you tune in again next week for the big three to continue the conversation as we seek to continue to grow in our understanding and depth of knowledge in order that we might follow Jesus more faithfully. Until then, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big Three podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are the Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.